Chapter 25, Prophetic Understanding. April 2nd, Earth. Man, a lot is going on. Our team on Earth is split up and working on different parts of the battle plan. The girls are training the Latians. Saturn and Janus are doing something with Jessica, Merlin, and the talismans back at the training cave. Ops and I are in Septumculus doing spy stuff and trying to teach me to teleport. Let's just say that the last part isn't working so well yet, and our whole visit to Septumculus is surreal. I've seen Raquel a few times since I've been back here on Earth, but I haven't seen Sean at all, and she seems to be acting strangely. She's been skipping school, not returning my calls or even my texts. Oh well, I'll find out what's going on tonight. The whole gang is meeting at Club S&M to share our stories. There are no phones on Earth, so this is the only way we can communicate. I wish we could do it more frequently, but our ability to know what is going on miles away on Earth still blows the Latians' minds. Sean hadn't arrived at the meeting, and I was beginning to get worried. But Ms. Dada assured us that our friend was just running late and suggested we get started. Nancy and Veronica wanted to go first, which was fine by me. I wasn't looking forward to sharing my mirth experiences. Narayana and Versera have been working with General Jeremy and our old trainer, Bor, who is now going by the name General Bor. They have amassed over 1,000 soldiers into a powerful army which will join us to attack Septumculus on the spring equinox. Nancy became super excited about a new secret weapon. She said that Janus and Granny had stopped by the Latian village on the way back to the training valley and trained General Bor with a new skill. Granny and Janus taught him how to share dragon experiences. Bor is a natural at it and can already simultaneously see through 3 dragons' eyes. He will have an illusion-free aerial view of the battlefield with the ability to coordinate the dragon's attacks. Veronica interrupted to demonstrate a scene, using her hands to represent 2 dragons flying in the sky. She brought them in from 2 directions while Nancy swooped a 3rd in to blast an imaginary castle. Malik and I couldn't help laughing when the 2 girls made sounds like kerploosh and boom as their imaginary dragons bombarded the castle. Us guys could easily picture ourselves making the same noises. Still, we found stylish Veronica and Nancy acting this way hysterical. The girls realized their puerile behavior and quickly stopped their demonstration. Veronica said, "I think it's time to hear Mark tell us what Stavius has been doing." I had been dreading sharing my story. After mumbling a few unintelligible words, I realized that I could no longer avoid it, took a deep breath, and began. Juice dropped Aunt Tessip and me in the fields near our old house late one night. We had agreed to use our mirth names while in enemy territory. The borders were sealed, and there was no way for us to get across the bridge. We spent a day or two at home before heading into the city, but we weren't prepared for what we found. Advian Castle, the zoo, and the new marketplace looked like a bombed-out war zone. The ground was still scorched, and most of the region was littered with rubble. The only area which had been cleared was the new marketplace. The new marketplace had been turned into a makeshift detention center and training ground. Troops were marching, running obstacle courses, and practicing various forms of close combat day and night. The city was full of soldiers in drab, dull, purple uniforms, and it appeared as though every able-bodied adult throughout the region had been drafted. Uniformed people stood guard on each corner, with posted lookouts on every tall building.
Also, there was a dusk-to-dawn curfew which we were warned to take very seriously. Violators were arrested, beaten, or killed, and lately, the nervous and power-infused troops were doing more beating than arresting.
I was concerned about where we would stay since we didn't have any reservations, but Aunt Tessip assured me that she had connections who would provide us with a room. I grumbled that I really didn't want to sleep in Mom's shed again, but my aunt just smiled and continued walking. Large trebuchets had been constructed and placed on the southern bank of the river. These massive weapons were designed to catapult large objects. Both Aunt Tessip and I were surprised to see them. Machines were rare on Mirth, and mechanical weapons were non-existent. Someone had brought technological knowledge from Earth, and the 7 families were using it. The potential power of combining technology with magic was terrifying. Neither Aunt Tessip nor I could guess at what the 7 families were planning to launch toward our invading army. Even worse, these weapons confirmed our fears that the Septumculans had people who traveled between the 2 worlds. The whole place felt like a different city or even a different country. I couldn't believe how quickly everyone accepted martial law. Septcumulus was no longer a place filled with art and life. Its citizens no longer idly chatted in cafes about the latest gossip or complained about their jobs. Now, no one complained, at least not out loud, and very few people smiled or waved hello. Most Septumculums just kept their heads down while going about their daily routine and trying not to be noticed. The place was depressing and scary, with every wall covered in purple and red political posters. Purple and red are Septumculus's official colors. They are supposed to represent the combination of our magical and organic lifebloods. Septumculums rarely flew flags, but often used bright versions of the colors for festive decorations. Now, however, flags flew everywhere, and the colors seemed muted in a way that made them appear more threatening. Perhaps it was just the overcast skies and drizzling rain, but the purple appeared to be more of a grayish hue, like the soldiers' uniforms, and the red appeared darker than usual, like a bloodstain on a battlefield. Neither Aunt Tessup nor I had read any of the signage until we reached the old marketplace. King Ringheld had erected a gigantic statue in the center of the crossroads by the end of the bridge. It was festooned with purple and red bunting, and there was no mistaking the identity of the oversized figure. The statue was of a man majestically firing battle magic from a wand with a 3-foot-tall inscription on its pedestal. Sir Stavius, Knight of Ringheld, Martyr of Septumculus. I suddenly noticed that every poster in view had my name on it. Be strong, be heroic, be Stavius. Fight for Septumculus, fight like Stavius. Ask what Stavius would do, then do it. Save us like Stavius.
I felt sick to my stomach. The 7 families had turned my disappearing act into propaganda. People were wearing Stavius pins and using my name as a rallying cry to defend the talismans from the rebels.
I also felt terribly exposed. I was enemy number 1 of the 7 families, standing under a 30-foot-tall statue of myself. Sure, I was using the name Staven, but really, how much of a stretch is that from Stavius? I made a comment to my aunt that we should leave, but she just laughed and pointed to the statue. Nephew, anyone here who knows you also knows how little magic you can perform. They would never believe that Chicken Slayer could possibly be the heroic warrior who single-handedly fights dragons and monsters with battle magic. Besides, that statue looks nothing like you.
I looked more closely at the statue and realized she was right. A small plaque explained how Stavius's likeness was carved from a first-hand description provided by King Ringheld's daughter, Mirabelle. Stavius is good-looking, but Mirabelle's imagination enhanced his appearance to the point of being unrecognizable. The heroic figure carved out of granite had chiseled features, bulging muscles, and a regal air which radiated power, dedication, and kindness. Stavius may be destined to become a god, but no sane person would confuse me with this caricature. I laughed and agreed with Aunt Tessup. We were safe as long as people thought that Stavius was dead and believed that this was how he looked when he was alive.
Aunt Tessup said that it was time for us to move on, though. She wanted to get us checked into our rooms and to introduce me to my teleportation tutor. We hiked up Vines Road, and my heart nearly stopped when she led us into an apparently vacant lot halfway up the hill. Aunt Tessup then stepped through the illusion and into the yard of the Traveler's Den. I warned, "Don't go in there, Aunt Tessup! That's where the Traveler's Den! It's where the vampire Borok lives!" She laughed and replied, "Yes, it is, although it might not be entirely correct to claim that Borok lives. He's been around so long that I'm not sure he qualifies as being alive." I couldn't believe it. Aunt Tessup was knowingly leading us into the den of a known vampire. But before I could say anything, Larsa came running out of the building to give Aunt Tessup a big hug. They chatted like old friends for a few seconds before Larsa turned to speak to me. "Well, Stavius, you certainly look good for being dead, although I am not one to talk," laughed Larsa. It was Aunt Tessup's turn to appear shocked. "Wait, you two already know each other?" Aunt Tessup asked in surprise. I said, "Yes, Larsa helped Janice and me get across the bridge into Septumculus and offered to let us stay at the Traveler's Den." Aunt Tessup quickly asked, "Then why did you choose to stay with my horrid sister?" I muttered, "Well, we felt something trying to lure us inside, and it seemed like a trap. We thought it was Borok trying to capture us. The desire to stay was so intense that we were hardly able to overcome it. We barely escaped, and now you're bringing me back. Both Aunt Tessa and Larsa stared at me in disbelief. Aunt Tessa finally said, "Well, you impress me once again, Staven. Few people have the strength and ability to ignore the call of a centuries-old vampire. Let me formally introduce you to the leader of the resistance against the Seven Families. I hope that she will be able to tutor you in the use of your unique abilities." Larsa reached out her hand and said, "Your aunt has been a trusted friend for many years. I would be honored to tutor you. There are very few vampires in the world, and even fewer with your impressive raw abilities. My true name is Borok, but I would prefer you to continue to call me Larsa." I was in shock for the third or fourth time that day. Aunt Tessa had suggested that the reason I struggled to perform magic was not that I was a less-than-human animal. Instead, it was due to me being a more-than-human vampire. I remember how shattered I felt when she first suggested that idea to me, but then it was only a suggestion. Now, I felt like I probably really was a vampire, and I was terrified. "But I can't be a vampire. I don't want to drain people's energy or drink their blood. I don't want to have to live in the dark or to control people's minds," I cried. Larsa laughed and said, "We don't drink blood or drain people's energy. Those are just rumors started by people who are scared of us and want to keep us away. We absorb our energy directly from the world around us, and while we can influence people's emotions, we aren't the monsters portrayed in fairy tales. Vampires like us can directly draw and shape magical power, but we struggle with using it like humans. We can't do simple parlor tricks, but we can hurl lightning bolts, influence thoughts and emotions, extend our lives indefinitely, and teleport. Those are all terrifying and threatening abilities to most humans, which is why the ruling class portrays us as monsters and strives to exterminate our kind." The more Larsa spoke, the more I realized how well I fit into her description. I guess I am a vampire. Then I asked the one other question which had been bothering me.
"You run the Traveler's Den. Does that mean you are conjoined? Were you a prophecy hero hundreds of years ago?"
Larsa laughed again and motioned for us to follow her inside the Traveler's Den as she explained. "Yes, I was conjoined long ago, but no, I was never a prophecy hero. Most people in this world are linked to people in the other world. Few, however, realize their connection and have the courage to journey here. Most simply pass this world off as a dream, if they remember the dream at all. I established the Traveler's Den as a haven for people who have made that journey. As you are well aware, the Seven Families treat travelers with as much suspicion as they do vampires. You were whisked away by the Soul Reapers to be trained. Most travelers don't have that benefit and arrive terrified and confused. We are constantly looking to rescue new arrivals before they are captured by the Seven Families and brainwashed to perform their bidding.
We empathetically project the desire to come into our home when they arrive. However, our attempt to lure you inside had the opposite effect."
We went inside the small Gothic-style house nestled in the side of the steep hill and discovered that it was enormous inside. It was really just the entrance to a massive network of tunnels and rooms carved deep into the hillside. Dozens of travelers, and I suppose vampires, lived there. This became my home for the next few weeks, where I've been living and studying teleportation while Aunt Tessa runs the spy network and plans for the revolution. Nancy said, "Wow, that sounds amazing. Why didn't you want to share it?" I dropped my eyes to the floor and muttered, "Because I stink at teleportation. After weeks of training, all I can do is make a rock shimmer a bit before popping right back to where it started. I can't even move a pebble. How am I supposed to be able to do anything useful?" Veronica put her hand on my shoulder and soothed, "Perhaps it just takes a lot more practice. After all, none of us could even do as much as you. Besides, Borok has been working on teleportation for hundreds of years. Don't be so hard on yourself, Mark." Sean added, "Or perhaps you are in the wrong place and time. Don't get discouraged, Mark. You'll be able to teleport when you need to." None of us had heard Sean come in, and we immediately began asking her what she had been doing, but Ms. Dada held up her hand to silence us. Ms. Dada said, "Chantel and I have been working on a project for the past few weeks, which requires utmost secrecy. We have reached a point where we need some assistance, but we must limit participation to the four heroes. I'm sorry, boys, but this part is just for Mark, Nancy, Veronica, and us. Malik, Tyler, and Ethan erupted in a chorus of, No fair! But Ms. Dada was firm.
She promised to share the secrets as soon as possible, but insisted that involving them would put the mission and the families of everyone involved at risk.
That, plus the subtle wink and nod I gave my friends to assure them that I would share everything I learned, silenced their complaints, and they trudged out of the meeting early. Sean smiled a thankful expression at Ms. Dada, and I realized that limiting this information to the travelers was her idea.
My stomach clenched as I began to wonder what could be so dangerous that it required excluding my most trusted friends.
She glanced in my direction, and I knew in an instant that, whatever it was, I would not be sharing it with the guys anytime soon. Sean looked nervous and scared.
Sean began by telling the girls about Jessica Janis and her explanation of the prophecy. She explained that Mirth is actually Earth about 12,000 years in the future, and that somebody even further in the future is beaming a signal into the past.
The signal's purpose is to send the information necessary to create magical energy back far enough in the past to prevent the end of the world. The prophecy contains the instructions of how to do this, while Janis and the heroes are the instruments to make it happen. The signal passes through the Earth twice in regions that appear equally spaced on land. It follows a sinusoidal path every 1,231 years, with differing effects depending upon whether the world contains magical energy during its pass. In pre-magical Earth, the signal causes civilizations in an affected region to transform their societies and religions using the number 7. It also causes select people in these areas to travel 12,000 years into the future in their dreams. The effects of this signal can be observed as far back as the Holocene epoch, which was 12,000 years in the past. The other time the signal passes through Earth is after magical energy has been introduced to the planet. The signal motivates those people to build 7 magical talismans in that period. The designs are precise, although no one really understands what they are or why they need to be fashioned in this manner. There is only a compelling desire to build the talismans, which is rewarded by magical power and influence. Cincinnati is in the current hotspot, while Jessica came from the next one, which will happen in Edmonton, Alberta in 1,231 years. Her team succeeded in bringing magic back to their world, and once it was established, she created a crystal ball like Merlin's to store her mind to assist us. This time travel business and meeting people from the past and the future is all pretty confusing to us, but here is how I understand it works. Merlin lived 1,000 years in the past, but figured out how to save his memories in a crystal ball. He created one using magic on Mirth about 9,800 years in our future, which both our team and Jessica's team found and opened. Jessica's team succeeded in bringing magic to Earth about 1,200 years in our Earth's future. She then used magic on Earth to create a crystal ball like Merlin's, which she stashed in Mount Rushmore for our Janis to find 9,800 years later. My head hurts, but Ms. Dada assures us that it all makes sense. I still don't understand why the guys couldn't hear this, and Sean hesitated before answering.
She said, Jessica insisted that I not share this next bit with anyone, including any of you. I am the key, and I'm supposed to make some decisions all by myself, but I just can't do it. I need your advice, and Jessica doesn't understand why, because she's from a different time and place.
Jessica talks about an apocalypse that nearly wipes out all life on this planet. The few survivors in her world knew that they only had a few hundred years left before the human race and most of the rest of the life on this planet became extinct. Her world was ending, so some of her decisions were far simpler to make than mine. Nancy complained, Stop being so cryptic, Sean. Tell us what decision you need to make. Sean had tears in her eyes as she answered, I need to decide whether or not we should fulfill the prophecy. Veronica nearly exploded as she shouted, How can you even ask that after all we've been through? Of course we should fulfill the prophecy. Somebody from more than 12,000 years in the future has been trying to bring magic back in time far enough to prevent the destruction of the world. Countless people have been struggling to make that happen for millennia. We've nearly lost our lives several times to get this far. You would seriously consider not completing it now that we have a real chance to make it happen? Unbelievable! Sean screamed, You don't understand! None of you understand! We can't pick and choose the parts of the prophecy we fulfill. It's all or nothing! The girl broke down and began sobbing while Ms. Dada comforted her, and we all stared in silence. A thought dawned on me. I said, "The prophecy stories all either talk about Janus coming to a barren and desolate world, or about him destroying the world and the gods rebuilding it. I'm guessing that what Sean is trying to tell us is that bringing magic back to our time will have serious consequences." Sean sniffled and said, "Yes, I don't know what will happen, but millions or maybe billions of people will die. Jessica says that it doesn't matter because everyone is going to die anyway if we don't succeed. However, if we do bring magic back to work, there is a chance that it will stop the apocalypse. Perhaps enough people will survive to continue our species." Veronica said, "Look, it seems pretty simple to me. It might be harsh, but either we believe in Jessica and the prophecy or we don't. If we believe in them, then we have to fulfill the prophecy for a chance to save the world." Nancy had been uncharacteristically quiet. She said, "Can you really do that? Sean said that people will die here right now, not in a few hundred years. If we go ahead and fulfill the prophecy, then we will knowingly be killing people. And with numbers like that, we'll probably be killing people we know. Are you willing to sacrifice your parents, brothers, sisters, and friends in the hope that maybe, someday, what we did will save the world?" We all sat there in silence for a long time.
Sean quietly explained how Jessica's heroes did not bring magic to Earth in time. There were less than 1 million people scattered in small, isolated communities on an increasingly uninhabitable planet when their dreams began. Nothing but the simplest of life forms would exist in a few centuries. The Earth's ecosystem was so fragile that the arrival of magic destroyed what little life was left. So, her gods used magic to repopulate the world with plants, animals, and people. However, everything on Earth is artificial and relies upon magic to survive. Whoever is transmitting this signal is attempting to instill magic into the Earth before the apocalypse. They are providing magic as a safer alternative to our technologies and their byproducts destroying our planet. The goal is for real human beings, plants, and animals to survive.
We all just sat in stunned silence until Mr. Narwani spoke. He summed up what we were all thinking with, "So we need to destroy the world to save it." Needless to say, I didn't share the stories about Jessica's world with the guys. I told them about future Earth, and they were as confused by all the time travel stuff as me. Of course, that's probably due to the way I explained something I don't entirely understand myself. We hung out talking about this most of Saturday morning until I kicked them out around lunchtime. I was going to spend the afternoon with Raquel. The guys teased me about it being a date, but I assured them that I was just going over to her place to see her dragon, Baby Juice. They were right, though. It did sort of feel like a date. Raquel and I hung out with Baby Juice for a while, then we went for a walk to a park near her house. We had a strange relationship because we could barely communicate. Raquel had difficulty speaking and would freak out if I talked too much or if there was too much other noise. Most of the time, we just quietly sat or walked together without saying anything. You would think that this would be boring, but I really liked it. I've never felt this way before. Today, however, she kept bumping into me on the way to the park, and I started to get annoyed. I was just about to snap at her after the fifth or sixth time her hand smacked into mine when I realized it was intentional. I took a chance and grabbed her hand. I felt her fingers intertwine mine and squeeze a moment later. Suddenly, we were holding hands as we finished our walk. We silently rocked on some swings and held hands for nearly an hour. It felt amazing. My whole body tingled as Raquel's thumb stroked the back of my hand. I couldn't believe that something as simple as touching someone's hand could feel so incredible. I found myself asking her out to the spring dance before I realized what I was doing. She didn't answer, of course. In fact, she didn't even look at me after I asked, but the way she tightly squeezed my hand conveyed her answer. I had a real date, and maybe I was even in love. I also knew that we had to fulfill the prophecy. We couldn't let a world perish where feelings like this exist. We had to save it. Not all of the others were convinced yet, but we decided to go ahead with the preparations anyway. Ms. Dada and Mr. Narwani seemed to be busily researching things online and buying all kinds of stuff. Sean and Ms. Dada were especially excited about some files Raquel gave me. Raquel may have trouble communicating, but she has an incredible memory. Sean and Ms. Dada had been trying to recreate some sort of programs Jessica had shown them. Elisa took one brief glance at them on Earth and instantly memorized thousands of lines of code. Her Earth visitor, Raquel, then painstakingly typed the code into a text file from her photographic memory. She had no idea what she was typing, but Sean and Ms. Dada knew what it was as soon as they saw the file. I have never seen two people become so happy in all my life as they quickly disappeared behind Ms. Dada's computer screen. Oh, and the other exciting news is that we're planning to go camping in Great Saltpeter Cave next week. Ms. Dada has a friend who's a member of the Greater Cincinnati Grotto, which is a chapter of the National Speleological Society, the NSS. They have a key to Great Saltpeter Cave, which is the same cave the heroes and I were training in on Mirth. I can't believe that we're going to actually visit the place here on Earth and to camp in the training valley. Malik, Tyler, and Ethan are also invited, and they are totally psyched to finally see a place I've been talking about for months. This is going to be so awesome.